And we're good.
So it's a little after 3 p.m. on April 26th. We're here at the headquarters of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. My name's Bart DeZivi. This is Scott Ganz. We're with the FCIC. I assume you know a little bit about us.
Sure.
And we're here right now to interview Diane Dobeck and Steve Manzari. And if the other participants for the Federal Reserve could identify themselves for the record.
Charlotte Leventhal, New York Fed Legal.
I'm sorry, I have to go through this script.
You sure? Can you hand me a pad?
Yeah, sure. Little white one or yellow one?
White one. Yeah, thanks. Out. Much appreciated.
I'd be better than a pencil.
And so as you noticed, this is being recorded for posterity. One of our missions is to examine sort of the financial crisis writ large, you know, well, all the turmoil. And also we have a bunch of other specified tasks, one of which is to look at the large institutions that failed and the large institutions that would have failed but for extraordinary federal assistance. That's the bucket into which Citigroup falls. That's why we're here to chat with you two today. I've got a pile of documents that we'll go through at some point in chronological order. But now that I've sort of worked my way up the food chain, I'll also want to have sort of higher level discussion with you two about sort of what you saw at Citi, what you had as relationships with the other supervisors, the SEC and the OCC. And just what your thoughts about sort of the overall process is. And just a reminder, you know, we're a federally created government commission, so there are provisions of Title 18 in the U.S. Code, many of which cover your work, that also cover our work, so that if anyone misleads the commission, that there are criminal penalties involved. So why don't we just start with some background information about the two of you and just for ease of repetition, I'll just always start with Diane.
Sure. Great.
So okay. We can go for
it. Always happy when Diane has to go first.
So just if you can, start from when you first started working for the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah. So I started working at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1997, and I joined an area called Policy and Analysis within Bank Supervision. And that area was charged, I should say I was there until I became the CPC for Citigroup in September 2005. Why don't I tell you a little bit about what I did in policy analysis, and then I can tell you sort of I overlapped with the former CPC or central point of contact and then took the realm in September 2005. So in policy analysis, we were charged with working a variety of issues, both within the U.S. agencies and internationally, predominantly related to regulatory capital. So it could be types of structures. We were developing either new policy or interpreting existing guidance. It would largely be the largest institutions that we would interact with, but we also dealt with a variety of institutions here that are supervised in the Second District. So they may be asking to issue a new capital instrument, refinance a capital base. We would think about what the composition should be. We also thought a lot about what the regulatory capital should be for the activities that they were undergoing. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with our capital rules, but the capital rules obviously need to be tweaked every so often because they can't keep pace. When they're written, they can't anticipate all the activity. When new activity comes about, we have a group of individuals around bank supervision, including risk experts, policy experts such as myself. We would involve legal, statistics, whatever the right combination was to think about what the new activity was, what the risks posed by that activity might lead to, and how we might need to interpret and or change our guidance. Also, I spent a fair amount of time working on the Basel II regime. I was one of the representatives from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I was on several of the working groups that got together periodically to talk about what changes we might need, because we were seeing, particularly in structured finance, changes in the activity. We felt that we had a gap in some of our rules, and also thinking about advanced risk management techniques, and that was being incorporated into what was the Basel II regime. So I also then, the unit also worked on a variety, predominantly capital and accounting related, but we also had corporate governance or other responsibilities depending upon what the issues were at the time. So I had, it required building a knowledge of a lot of different types of technical questions, also having to work on an interagency basis, because often, as you may be aware, because the activities are nested within a consolidated organization, depending upon which legal vehicle they may touch and how they roll up to the consolidated entity, we would have to obviously problem solve internally with our colleagues at the board, other agencies, and then if it was in the Basel context, with the Basel committee members.
And so September 2005, that's when you became CPC for city.
Right, and I had a six-month overlap with the former CPC. While I had worked on much institutional, so if a firm came in, Citigroup would have been one of the firms that we would have problem solved around in the policy context.
Mm-hmm.
But I also overlapped with the then CPC just to get a better feel for the range of responsibilities. Also, I went out on maternity leave for a portion of that. So it was a good overlap, but I also had a personal reason.
And who's the prior CPC?
Homer Hill.
Right.
Yeah. So I was on maternity leave from June to September.
Okay. And how long did you remain CPC?
I was CPC from the... I began, I believe, the last week in September, and I ended May 2007. And that's when I moved over to the risk function within the bank supervision group, and I headed up the credit risk department.
And are you still the head of the credit risk department?
I am not. I have done a little bit of a full circle, and now I'm head of the supervisory and regulatory policy area. I should say between my stint on the credit risk, I did become the senior relationship manager for Citigroup in November, so I was head of credit risk.
Okay.
I looked to Steve because Steve had that position just prior to me. It was about October 2008 that I was led the Citigroup and J.P. Morgan senior relationship position.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You had to go back.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sorry, Diane.
So can you explain to me how that
came about?
Well, yeah, and how that's different than sort of...
Sure. So right now, a central point of contact, what we... The central point of contact is the main liaison, heads up a team, and then reports into a management structure. What had happened, and I don't know the timing of it, but it could be a case that you could have several organizations within a senior officer. What we determined was there was a need here in bank supervision to make the portfolio smaller and group-like institutions. So, for example, we have a senior relationship officer who is the main point for the CPCs over foreign institutions. I was the main senior relationship officer for Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. We have a senior relationship officer who's over the processing banks, for example. What it is to allow for consistency in approach, to contrast and compare a natural peer group on analytical issues as well as approach to supervision. So two CPCs would report to a senior officer.
To the SRO.
Yeah, we call it senior relationship manager.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who does the senior relationship manager?
In New York, SROs have a whole different name.
Yes, yeah. to the head of the relationship area. So we have four departments in bank supervision. It would be risk, relationship, financial sector policy and analysis, which I report into, and resource, logistics, and management, which is more of our operations within bank supervision group.
The back office.
Yeah.
See, this way she gets all this stuff out of the way.
Well, I appreciate that. I told you. I said right up front. I'm always happy when Diane goes first.
Yeah.
It's my job easy.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that gets us up to current.
That is? Yeah.
All right.
Oh, so I started in the bank in August 1992, out of grad school. I worked at the bank through 2000. I think it was December of 2000, maybe January 2001. Then I went to the private sector.
So when you were here in that first stint, were you in the bank supervision group?
I was in bank supervision for the majority of that period of time, about 6 years. I basically did a, I worked on what, well, I guess it's morphed, as many, has had many names over the years, but effectively they created a unit dedicated to reviewing the quantitative risk measurement processes at supervised institutions. And that was part of the development and implementation of the market risk amendment to the Basel Capital Accord. So, I mean, basically, you know, this was an attempt to put on, implement the market risk amendment to the Basel Capital Accord, which required, you know, supervised institutions to undergo special examinations and review of their risk measurement processes. So I was on that team, and then I actually eventually ran it. And that occurred between 1992 and, say, 1998 or thereabouts. There was a brief period of time when I entered the bank that I wasn't on that team, but eventually I was assigned. I can't recall how long I've been here.
Sure.
I spent a majority of my time in the initial time at the New York Fed in basically bank examiner in the field doing bank examinations. The last 2 years I was at the bank, I won't go through the turns and twists, but eventually I became the secretary of the bank's, call it investment committee. And when I say investment committee, that's not financial investments, but basically strategic investments, large dollar capital expenditures, usually technology infrastructure or building projects, you know, floor renovations, leasing space, etc. So I did that for 2 years, and then I went to the private sector for about a little less than 6 years or so. And I came back in May 2006. Back to bank supervision. I was hired back to run the market and liquidity risk department within the risk function of bank supervision.
And so who is your...
Brian Peters. I work directly for Brian Peters.
You work for Brian Peters. And who is your predecessor?
Zahra El Mokawi.
Can you spell that for me?
Z-A-H-R-A. And it's El Mokawi, E-L, space, M-E-K, two Ks?
I think it's two Ks, A-W-Y.
I think
A-W-Y.
So.
But I can tell you in a second, because I'll look her up in here.
And at market and liquidity risk, what was your function?
Yeah, two Ks, A-W-Y.
I'm sorry. I was a vice president. Is that the question?
What was your function? What was your?
So I ran a group of technical experts whose risk discipline was market risk, measurement, management, monitoring, and let's say with liquidity risk. So as you learn more about like our supervision process, I mean Diane talked about relationship. In there, and then we call it risk.
Yeah, so,
you got all that already? Okay, great. So I supplied those the experts that did those types of reviews at financial institutions. We also built out, effectively a monitoring function as well. I think there was about 25 to 30 people. I can't remember my department.
And bringing us up to current.
So this is, I'll give you the twists and turns to bring you up to the current, because a lot of this has to do with events that unfolded, you know, in late 07, early 08. So in late 07, the sort of liquidity pressures in the financial system started to intensify.
Right.
There was a lot of work done by my department in support of the Federal Reserve monitoring of those situations and our responses to that. Then in March of 2008, I was sent to Bear Stearns Thursday night and led a team of people on site there. Managed the on-site monitoring efforts of those institutions until a more formal process could be arranged. And that lasted about a month or so. We did that. And then it had already been agreed that I would be was going to go to Citigroup. I'd become the senior relationship manager there. So I eventually, you know, was able to. They set the on-site monitoring effort up, and I was moved to Citigroup.
In April, May?
April, May. You have to remember.
Ish. Things,
yeah. I just want to be clear that, you know.
There's overlap.
Well, it's also that when all the Slack came out of the system, not that there was much Slack to begin with, we had a staff the on-site monitoring efforts at the broker-dealers. Someone had to cover my department. There were things we needed to focus on pretty rapidly. So, I mean, there was a bit of things all had to move around. So I can't actually recall when I was formally released from the old responsibilities and assigned to the new ones. So I spent, from that period, say late April, May, at Citigroup as the senior relationship manager there. And at that time, that was my only responsibility, was Citigroup. Sometime during the summer of 2008, J.P. Morgan was brought under that umbrella. And then in September of 2008, I was moved to AIG to lead the on-site effort at AIG. And that you will see sync up to shortly thereafter when Diane was assigned to be the senior relationship manager, once again, of Citi and J.P. Morgan. And I'm still on the AIG team today.
Okay. Did you get all that?
Yep. And I told Steve he's probably going to go to a few privileged folks to get interviewed by two FCIC teams.
It's a privilege.
That's right. Maybe three.
No.
Okay. Oh, no.
So let's start with some of the big picture issues. And again, I'll start with Diane first. Tell me about how you interact with folks at the OCC, what the sort of level of the contact is there, what the title of the person is, who it was specifically, if you recall,
sure.
And the sort of things that you would communicate about mm-hmm. on a regular basis and then on a sort of as needed when there were problems.
Sure. So the OCC had a team assigned to the national entities. So it was Citibank NA and Nevada, the credit card bank. The person in charge of the OCC team is called the examiner in charge, and that individual was named at the time Scott Waterhouse. And he had, I can't recall exactly how the team was structured, but he would have a number of deputies that would divide up by, I think, risk specialty, if you will. The team had a number of functions, applications-related functions, examination functions, and monitoring functions. And the reason I draw that distinction is I would have interacted with him personally. I think we had at least a weekly or a biweekly standing meeting between us. The members of my team and the members of his team would have interacted daily to talk about things such as what exams or what meetings we're going to have, what exams, what subject matter. I would say that the relationship was at times assertive and tense, in part because the OCC had very specific views about what they thought was within their purview of examination and were reluctant and often would prefer for us not to attend meetings or have discussions with them. They tended to have discussions, I would say, I'm sure as many colleagues have indicated, much of the activity is done by business line and
right.
cuts across different legal vehicles.
Right.
They would have meetings by business line, often with what would be considered corporate or consolidated management structure, and then they would have meetings that would talk about not just the bank but other activities. And so we thought, let's go to the same meetings, let's try to figure out what the issues are. At times that was successful, at times it was not. They tended to focus quite heavily on the consumer-related or mortgage-related, I would say, activity, because that was, at the time, if my recollection's right, predominant in the bank. So I guess just to recap, I would have frequent meetings with the EIC and discussions. We would want to share findings. We would often, if we did exams jointly, we would talk about what our collective perceptions were and what we wanted to communicate to the firm. Even if we didn't have a joint exam underway, we would be talking about what we were hearing and finding. And then the persons on my team would interact with the persons on his team quite frequently and attend meetings, if not many of them would interact daily and attend meetings together where as much as possible in a given week.
Okay. Steve?
So if we're talking about the OCC specifically, that's
right.
It's kind of complex. Do you want me to focus on my time at Citi?
No.
Oh, okay.
Did you want to revise? You
know. Yeah, the only thing I could also say, just not limited to that perspective, but then we would, similar to us, as we had senior relationship officers over groups, they too had similar structure. So we would interact with the EIC or the effective senior relationship officer, depending upon the issues, either to inform them, to discuss approaches. So there was more than just the team-to-team contact, but as the CPC, I would have primarily talked to the EIC if we had a difference of opinion or some consequential decision that we needed to inform both our management teams, we would inform and be involved with conversations at the next level.
Okay. Hmm.
Okay, so so it depended on where I was at in the institution at the time. So when I was in market liquidity risk, either myself or my boss would have conversations with folks at the OCC who were looking at like broader issues in the financial system. And so, for instance, comparing notes on what we were seeing in terms of liquidity trends at financial institutions, even involved in some kind of conversations about what we were seeing in terms of credit trends. So when I had a multi-institution perspective, we typically engage with folks at the OCC who were kind of tasked with a very similar kind of like, purview across a range of institutions. Often those efforts were dedicated to coordinating our activities so that, for instance, if, my department were going out and trying to pull together information across a range of financial institutions for purpose X, Y, or Z, we wanted to make sure that we were synced up with the OCC folks who may or may not be doing something similar. If they were not doing that, we would obviously invite them to participate. And if they were doing it, it would be an opportunity to kind of, coordinate our activity with the institutions to be more, more efficient. Now, in terms of the period of time that I was at the city specifically, I tell you that most of my interactions with the OCC were directly more limited, frankly, because the way the city CPC team was arrayed, the staff on the city CPC team had already identified their counterparts on the OCC, within the OCC, and spent a fair bit of time, those were pretty well-worn connections. So folks, my team that covered credit, they knew who their counterparties were on the ops risk, the same thing, compliance, etc. In terms of, I think it was Scott when I was there, I can't actually recall. Because he was there when you went
left,
back, right?
Yeah. Left credit.
So, no, but they brought somebody new.
No, sorry. He was replaced
John Lyons.
John Lyons, that's right. And I don't know when Steve got moved to AIG and I went back to the relationship side, John Lyons was there. I do not know when he had arrived.
October 2007, right? In the whole.
Okay.
That makes sense. Because I think it wasn't Scott when I was there.
Okay.
Because sort of, the current CPC at Citi at that time would have interfaced, with John. I was sort of didn't need to have a direct interface with the OCC, and a lot of those interactions happened with John. Now, that being said, one of the things that that we, on the team, we were always very cognizant of was making sure our approach to Citigroup was coordinated between the two agencies. It was not sensible for us to, you know, have one approach at the holding company and Citigroup Inc. and sort of, you know, the OCC take a radically different approach. Also, I had to be very cognizant of what we were doing, was consistent with Grand Leach Bliley, for instance. Making sure that assessments that were made that were in the banking organizations that the OCC had responsibility for were assessment, and we would rely on those assessments as opposed to, for instance, me making my own view of what the banking institution's, financial condition. That's the type of thing that we would want to know what the OCC was thinking. And there was coordination amongst the Fed and OCC in terms of all the different actions that occurred with respect to the company in terms of the MOUs, the roll-ups that were going to happen, development of the suit plan, etc.
Okay. Now to talk about sort of Citi generically, mm-hmm. The impression that I formed just from my very skimming along the surface here at the Fed, at the Board of Governors, at the OCC, is that compared to other similarly sized financial institutions, both bank holding companies and banks and even investment banks, that they had a much more decentralized management structure than other institutions, and that it was not only decentralized, but they were also sort of siloed in that people in one business unit, not necessarily legal entity, but actual, functioning business unit, would not necessarily communicate with people in a related business unit that were off doing something else. The prime example of that is the folks running the CDO desk would not communicate on a regular basis with the folks involved in the securitization desk, who are putting together RMBS from subprime mortgages that they buy from AmeriQuest and elsewhere. And then on top of that, you have an organization that had built up over time through acquisitions, and that the systems architecture was not sort of one thing. It was cobbled together as they kept adding on new bits and pieces to the institution. And so when you look at this sort of an institution from my very surface perspective, it seems to make risk aggregation a very difficult enterprise given those factors. Would you concur and say that on a sort of generic level that you would agree that those things were factors that made Citi a little different than other large institutions? And do you also concur that risk aggregation was a little more difficult for Citi than other large institutions?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to, because I don't know the other, I don't know the breadth of the other activity, but I do have a similar view that they were managed as businesses, business lines and the business heads. My recollection is we often met with each of the business heads and also tried to test the degree to which they were speaking with each other and try to look at the MIS and get a sense of how do they think about the picture as a whole. I would say on risk aggregation, I do also recall, particularly when they were going, I believe it was end of 2006, early 2007, they were doing a number of acquisitions in the consumer area. And speaking to them about what is your process for integrating. When you buy a new company or you're looking to buy a new process, what is the integration plan? Because we were concerned also about the degree to which all of their systems could communicate with each other. So I had the impression that, for example, also we spent a lot of time thinking about some of the capital markets or issuer risk, different types of concentrations they might have to financial institutions or corporates. We could see evidence of the firm trying to think about a loan equivalent of their exposure to a given class of entity. So I don't think, in hindsight, I'm not sure that they would have necessarily, or they did capture or think about all their risks in a, the world has stopped and it's a really adverse environment. And I agree that in terms of, you know, it's one thing to aggregate the risk on a notional or some sort of loan equivalent. It's another thing to challenge the assumptions that you're making and think about, you know, it's a terrible environment and how much could you be exposed to? And that, I agree, was not as developed. I mean, I think that's a looking back perspective. I don't think at the time we had a full appreciation for it. Also, you mentioned about the infrastructure. When I was there, we are focused on the infrastructure. They had an incredible number of information security breakages and leakages. So we were both looking at it from how they quantify their risk, but then how do they protect consumer information? And I think part of that was the information security element was a big focus of ours at the time, because they were seemingly small amounts of data and recovery was quick, but it had the reputational risk. It was reverberating in terms of similar types of leakages of consumer information happening globally. And at that time, much of their franchise, 50%, was overseas. And right. So there was a lot of, I just recall a lot of discussion around how we're securing information. Separately, we were having conversations about how are you quantifying your risk more generally aside from the information security. And they seem to have a lot of projects or processes underway, in part from some of their own findings or findings that we would have had with the OCC about not quantifying or not having a strong control, and then coming up with a way to bring it online, stress it, capture it, make it more of a real-time risk capture, I would say.
Okay.
I'm trying to, I think there's a, so are we allowed to ask questions?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm just looking at my, the person absolutely. That runs this process from my side. So I think your question is, and it seems like in your question is sort of an assumption of causality that if Citi's risk aggregation systems had been, you know, highly efficient, very integrated, very complete, that there would have been a realization at Citigroup that we have too much exposure to, and you can articulate this a number of ways, subprime space, to consumer credit in the United States, to, I mean, like I said, you can articulate it different ways. Is that the assumption?
That's sort of a later piece of the pie, but the first, you know, you can't manage it if you can't measure it, and so the first question I have simply is just going to the measurement and their ability to do a good risk aggregation across business units, that it appeared to be more of a challenge. Again, from a very superficial level, from someone outside, it appeared to be more of a challenge for Citigroup than for similarly sized institutes.
So, other institutions. Let me I think that's clearly what we said to Citi, that their aggregate, I believe if I get the roll-up letter in 08, correct if my memory serves, and, you know, what we found there, you know, was very clearly that they had difficulty aggregating the risk. But I think there's a, I would just, it's my belief, my personal belief, that there's a more subtle relationship to failures in risk management, to data aggregation than it's, gee, you just can't aggregate it up and here's a big number and, geez, that's not. Because remember, data aggregation is itself an abstraction, right? You know, businesses, they're not dynamic, for instance. And you may have a book of business and may believe that you can manage through a situation because you're going to be making money as you're, you know, modifying your book of business. You may be able to hedge it. There are always alternatives that, you know, are very difficult to model. And so you may have, you know, call it, you know, consumer credit risk A, B, C, and D, and they all may have different unmodeled you know, elements to it that may give you a very different, you know, may give you a very different true level of risk in a crisis. You know, that being said, I think the issue of being able to roll up risk is really one of, you know, what is the risk function's role? Is it production of a report, or is it to stand in, as equals against business folks who are highly incented to generate revenue and use the firm's capital base to enrich both themselves but also the shareholder? And I think that's actually where you come to a truer, you know, measure of that type of failure's impact on risk measurement. Does the business area, I'm sorry, does the risk function, are they able to say to the senior management of the firm, look, are you comfortable with this? Because if X occurs, here's how much we made last year from this risk in this business, and here's how much it could cost you. Right? We used to talk about Kidder Peabody back, you know, my first tour here at the Fed, and we used to laugh about how many toaster. This is all going in, so can I just tell you, we used to talk about how many toaster ovens and jet engines and locomotives GE had to sell before it made up the loss it experienced in Kidder Peabody. And if someone, you know, brought that to the table and said, here's what you can lose in this business, people will generally react rationally to that. And am I comfortable with that? And I think that's the more, I think, subtle relationship. It's never as simple as, gee, look, we can make a giant number on paper.
Right.
It has to be, you know, put into context to the vulnerability that that number really means. And that's very subtle. And I don't think generating information from far-flung. Now, let me also say one thing about decentralization at Citigroup, because I think this is important. I think Citigroup is decentralized. What I would suggest about the decentralization of the city is it clearly created challenges there. What's hard to understand is the extent to which that decentralization also created business opportunities for the company. And the reason I say that is I think people have said, you know, here's an institution that's too large to manage itself. I don't think that's inconsistent with what we have said to it and what our, you know, exams that we have found. And I think the people you've talked to, you will see that. But the ability to operate in 100 different jurisdictions, create revenue in 100 jurisdictions, create the diversification that goes along with that, is really powerful. And it's, you know, if you had the opportunity to create two different worlds, one with city highly centralized and one with it highly decentralized, I don't know how that would work out for you in the end. So I just, that doesn't, but just to be clear so I don't give you the wrong impression, that actually places greater emphasis on the need for risk, the risk function in an organization to do its job very, very well.
Okay, well, let's talk a little more specifically about some of the business lines at Citi. How familiar are you with the CDO business as it was run in the 05, 06, 07?
I can speak to Georgia.
Sure.
So we had, from my recollection, in 2005 and 2006, we were changing our approach more broadly, I would say, to supervision. That sounds maybe too dramatic. We were thinking about things, had been focused a lot on some of the cultural, and Citi was under a number of enforcement actions, I would say, generally.
Right.
Highly related to compliance risk management, legal, reputational risk. In 2005 and 2006, we continue to focus on the strength of those controls, but also generally, I would say, across city and other similarly situated institutions, we're thinking more about complex illiquid exposures, structured credit. So Citigroup would have naturally been one of the firms that examiners on the risk side would have looked at and we would have looked at as well. So there had been, Citi had been subject to what we call horizontals, some of which were related to its counterparty credit risk, mostly related to hedge funds, which wouldn't have necessarily been the CDO business, looking at complex illiquid inventory and how they were pricing it. Also, there was a European trading, derivatives trading review that took place, which where we were partnering with the OCC, because it was, if I recall correctly, it was synthetic CDO business that was being done out of London through a they called it a correlation trading desk.
Right.
We would have partnered with the OCC because the OCC has a London office that takes a look at this type of activity, and obviously we were interested in it because of growth and its impact on the business line and the business line rolling up to the consolidated organization. So we were having lots of different touch points, both at Citi and with Citi in contrast to other firms, to try to get perspective on were the practices that we were seeing unusual, concerning, was there a general move that needed to be made in terms of our expectations for all firms or for a business specific to Citi. That would have been the responsibility of, if it was a market, I think the title was, the risk coordinator was market and liquidity risk. We've since changed it to have it be market, counterparty, and credit risk. So this would have, a number of people would have been involved on the CPC team and the exam team, either doing exam work, what we call continuous monitoring, which would have been the context of monitoring MIS in meetings with management to try to get a better feel for what were they doing, if they had a growth perspective, if there was a struggle with controls, what was happening, what kind of plans were they putting in place to try to remediate some of the weaknesses that we were seeing.
So my sort of general understanding of the evolution of the CDO business with respect to the subprime MBS in particular is that they had come up with a structure in the early part of the decade where they would create a special purpose entity that they would then warehouse various MBS pieces until they got enough sort of critical mass there. Then they would create the CDO in this entity that was managed by a separate investment firm. And the CDO pieces would be sold off except for the super senior tranche of the CDO, principally because the spread over LIBOR, or however you wanted to measure it, was so narrow that most people didn't view that as an attractive investment. And so in our discussions with the OCC, they said they didn't think the super senior tranche of a CDO linked to subprime, in fact, had ever been sold. And that the SPE would then fund itself by issuing asset-backed commercial paper secured by the CDO. But again, the asset-backed commercial paper could not be sold except for a liquidity put from Citibank NA.
So maybe I can break a couple of things down? Yeah.
I just want to ask you a question. When you say the CP couldn't be sold except for a liquidity put, just to be clear, that was to obtain an A1, P1, F1 rating on the CP.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding?
Yeah.
It's not that the market wouldn't have borne. This would be clear.
If you issue it at a different rating and the underlying yield on the AAA CDOs, you're upside down, right? I mean, that's
right. So maybe just to kind of take a step back. So Citi played a number of roles. That's true. And so I think the portion you're talking about is they would have structured for cash CDOs, kept a super senior position, and then bundled super senior ABS with other exposures into a CP vehicle. A couple of things. I think the super senior CDO, because of all the different market indicators, including some of the regulatory, the subordination, the ratings assigned to it, it would have had, as you say, probably not generated a lot of fee income and also seen as quite riskless in terms of regulatory capital and other measures we would have at the time. I think getting to the, so the super senior, you could packaged into a CP vehicle. I think getting to Steve's point, banks would have, banks are natural providers, or have been, I don't know if they will be so much in the future, of liquidity facilities, liquidity puts, credit enhancements to CP vehicles, in part because of their rating to get a highly rated CP inventory that investors would be attracted to. So I would say in this case, the liquidity put was negotiated or part of the deal, part of the structure, to get the rating, to get then investors, due to their investment policies, interested in being able to purchase a CP, as I would put it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so diving into another sort of area of your expertise, in looking at a liquidity put versus sort of a standby letter of credit, that the 364-day liquidity put, which is not triggered on default, but is triggered upon a disturbance in the commercial paper market, which means you can't issue it within a specified spread, had a much more favorable risk-based capital treatment than a standard credit charge on a backup letter of credit.
Right, so a couple of things. So there would have been lines of credit, 364 days, but there's also a second set of recourse rules related to liquidity facilities. So it was, it's more in-depth than just the 364-day maturity. There were also attributes in a version of the securitization rules that speak to not just general market disruption, but also what's the credit quality on the underlying receivables or the collateral in the CP vehicle. There are some other guideposts in there for liquidity facilities to securitization vehicles that wouldn't just be the maturity date. And depending on if those are, those guideposts around perceived credit quality of the underlying collateral were met, then I can't recall what the charge is, but there is a charge associated with a liquidity facility to an ABCP type vehicle.
But for a liquidity put, if you structure it correctly, it's much less than.
I'd have to go back and see.
Okay.
I don't know. I recall at one time, but then the rules were revised, the securitization
rules.
So I don't want to misspeak.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
When you say a standby letter of credit, you mean an instrument that bears credit risk.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That expressly
bears.
By design. Yes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to be,
right.
You know, make sure I
yeah,
understood
right.
that.
Yeah.
Right. So then at some point, the Treasury group with inside Citigroup, to our knowledge, says, wait a minute, you know, you've issued $23 billion of these liquidity puts. That's kind of enough because we're concerned about having this stuff come back onto our balance sheet if certain things are triggered, and eventually the number goes up to 25 as they fill the deals. So once they hit that cap, then the business kind of morphed a bit, and instead of creating SPEs into which the super senior tranches were put, they created two methods of continuing to issue CDOs, as I understand it. There were synthetic CDOs created through credit default swaps in which Citibank NA was the booking entity. And then there were the cash CDOs where they're still gathering up the actual physical MBS assets. But the broker-dealer and the non-bank would then keep those CDO pieces on its books, so it's no longer in SPE, but the actual super senior tranche of the CDO ends up on the books of the
And my recollection
non-bank.
Is, I do agree that my recollection of Citi played a role in each of those markets. I did not understand it to be tied to the liquidity put is now limited, and therefore you have to try to find other avenues as alternatives, but rather different entities within the consolidated organization were playing different roles in the CDO market. So there was the warehousing or building up of third-party, I'll call them receivables, to package, which would be typically done through a broker-dealer or non-bank affiliate. There was also some investment that would have been translated into a cash CDO, the super senior position of which they would have had and then bundled through a CP vehicle. They would have then had investors who were interested not in cash positions but in synthetic exposure, so they would have come up with a synthetic based on an index or combination for other investors. I did not understand it to be limit is put on liquidity put. Now let's try to figure out alternative methods for remaining active in this business.
Okay. So looking at some of the work by your brethren over at the OCC in this time period, there's a document, F1. It's a letter from Ron Frake to Jeff Coley. And if you could just, it's only like three paragraphs, so if you could just take a minute to read that letter. So I guess my first question is, in particular, do you recall seeing this letter?
I don't recall, but I think this would have been related to work we were doing on in the London operation. I think ours, we called it European Credit Derivative Trading.
Right.
Yeah.
So the language in here was fairly tough for a letter. And, you know, we interviewed Mr. Frake at length. And going to the second page, he says, given this oversight failure, we're considering options that would limit the bank's ability to perform future business. So what he told us was that given what they'd seen at the CDO desk, they were considering putting, you know, a fixed limit on until improvements were made in the process. Now, at the time, did you have that same level of concern based on...
So we had, I recall, many conversations about, and I believe this was related to their synthetic activity on the correlation decks in London. And I have the impression, or my recollection is that it was new business, or it was they were doing something that their infrastructure and controls were not... They were using or outdated, or I don't quite know how to describe the right words, but their infrastructure was offline. It didn't have current price feeds. And we also expressed concerns, and my recollection is that management said, we are pausing. We have to evaluate. Here's all the different things. We've identified problems. I think their audit actually identified it around the same time. These are the things that we are doing to put into place. We're not going to grow the business significantly until we... you know, put these fixes in place. I do not recall us talking about a dollar cap on business, but expressing concern and having met with the chief credit risk officer at the time. And
that would have been David Bushnell?
Yes, it was David Bushnell. It would have been part of our normal process of closing out exams. I think this was also something that we raised in our annual inspection report at the time.
Okay, so F32. Mm-hmm. Is dated November 3rd, 2005.
I think I might have. Oh, yes, okay.
Want to take
is
just
this
a.
The, yeah. Oh, control? Okay.
So this is the control.
Oh, okay,
this is sort of the Enron.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
As I'm calling it, the Enron written agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So if you go to page 8.
Okay.
The third paragraph down, the starts CIB Structured Finance Group. If you could just take a few minutes and read that paragraph.
Mm-hmm. And it begins CIB structured finance is the third full paragraph?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'll get on to the European exam shortly, but I just wanted to chat about the review that was done because of the written agreement. In looking at sort of what the Fed has done and what the OCC has done in looking at the written agreement.
May I look at the timing of the other letter, the OCC letter?
Sure.
Was it...
In looking at the work done around the written agreement, mm-hmm. Both at the Fed and at the OCC, it seems to have been a fairly narrow review that instead of looking at the written agreement and the references therein to due diligence with respect to underwriting, that they were focused mainly on sort of technical compliance of the terms of the agreement and looking to structures to see if there was reputational risk. So,
yeah, I would say, so my recollection is that the written agreement spoke to processes. It was about transactions that were for circumventing tax or accounting
right.
protocols. And what was the legal and reputational risks associated with that? and therefore, our work would have looked at the processes to assure pardon me, that each product was subject to their policies and procedures. It was not at underwriting.
Right.
So we would have, I think we had done work for maybe 2 years, perhaps, that looked at the strength of the processes, what they were doing to bring all the different disciplines around the bank together by business line for attacking these types of issues.
So this is a document underlying that review. It's previously been marked F4. And if you could just take a minute to read the transaction details, which is sort of a summary of what this person was looking at for this examiner worksheet. So in speaking to the EIC, Mr. Dermasi, on this, basically he was saying that this was part of a review in which the underlying credit function wasn't reviewed. And my question to him was, okay, well, at what point would sort of an examiner who's doing this narrow focus, you know, compliance with the agreement thing, mm-hmm. If they see something they think is interesting, odd, unique, troubling, you know, at what point would they sort of see something and go, you know, maybe I should take this over to the guys in market risk, or maybe I should take it over to the guys in credit risk, and how often would that happen?
So I would, I can't speak to the specific issue, but
right.
we would, we try to approach every issue on the CPC team in that manner. Rather than, so the CPCs are, the risk coordinators are structured, typically they follow a business line or a risk. And we would say, okay, that you may have traditionally looked at, the offer risk coordinator would have looked at IT-related elements, BARD would have been the person who would have looked at the written agreement compliance. But the issues are multifaceted, so let's sit down and talk about what are we hearing, why do we think this is a problem. So we're hopeful that that kind of dialogue will elevate issues as their commonality, because as we say, business lines cut across different legal vehicles and have lots of different risks associated with them. I don't know if that would have happened in this case, but there would be lots of opportunity.
So who in which subunit either in the CPC team or in the risk team would be generally looking at the credit risk, if there is any, in an off-balance sheet vehicle. Who would be responsible for saying, yeah, there's this stuff, it's over in an SPE, it's over in an SPV, SIV, whatever your acronym of choice is. But it's possible this stuff could bounce back on our balance sheet under conditions A, B, or C at Citigroup. So which team member?
I would say we would tend to think about that. So I'll try to give an answer of what when I was there at the time and now in hindsight.
Sure.
So at the time, we would have thought about, is it a arm's length SPE that they don't have any financial control to? Financial risk associated or economic risk associated with it. So it's met all the tests for this to be an off-balance sheet item
right.
that they're not legally responsible for. And then what other ties might they have? We would typically look at it in the context of securitizations, credit card securitizations had or CP vehicles that had liquidity facilities, which we talked about, traditional, not necessarily the super senior CDOs.
Right.
I don't think we would have... In hindsight, knowing what I know now, it would have been a terrific question to say, now help us understand what the composition of all those assets are for which you don't have a legal obligation, but you may support for a variety of reasons. At the time, I recall us thinking about their off-balance sheet exposures and trying to get a managed asset view of the organization, but I don't think we would have systematically thought about what's the composition of the pools, other than it happens to be credit card, this looks like corporate receivables. We would have a general understanding, but wouldn't have necessarily dissected, would be my...
Okay.
I don't know if you would have a different...
Did you have anything to add, Steve?
No, I think in general, one of the most important things that the examiners do are think about situations that the financial institution is not thinking about and, you know, understanding... What would happen if, you know, the, you know, one out of a million event occurs within an organization? I think that's exactly what they do. That dialogue happens quite a bit with folks in all areas. That's primarily one of the most important things that we do is provide an outside and independent perspective on something. You know. So you asked the question of how would that dialogue happen? It would happen through the normal review process, you know, an exam, discussions with the CPC team, talking to the risk examiners that look at something. So it happens in that entire mix of activities. I caution you, it's not a specific activity. It's sort of, you know, an activity that occurs all the time.
Sure. Okay, so now we'll go to F12, which is the product memorandum, the result of the European credit derivatives exam.
Is there a base number on that again?
631. So why don't you just take a minute to read the executive summary on the first page that goes until the bold on the second page. So in looking at the letter from Mr. Frake of December 22nd, mm-hmm. The issues raised in this executive summary are extremely similar, mm-hmm. not surprising since there were OCC examiners who mm-hmm. participated in this as well. So would you say that you were essentially sort of on this page as the OCC at that point in time with your...
So this is the product memo. I recall, I think we had similar but slightly different in tone in terms of what we communicated to the firm. My recollection is we two were concerned about the infrastructure, the rate of growth. I also recall we put it on senior management and I think the board perhaps to just sort of, they needed to look into it, determine what the problems were, the fixes, and then at what point would they be comfortable or say that they corrected everything to then consider growing again, which I think is slightly different. If this one seems to say we're considering options, I think ours spelled out more what our expectations were of them, if my recollection is right.
Okay. So then I'd like to go to F13.
Dates number, sorry, not our arranged by dates rather.
87619, the summary of the supervisory roll up for that year. Okay. So this is what actually, if I understand it, goes to the board of directors of Citigroup, correct?
Yeah, so this would be the annual inspection report, and there would have been a number of, so for example, this exam would have its own target letter or examination finding letter, which would go separately.
Okay.
And this would be the culmination of all the work.
So if I go through this letter,
yep.
I see a reference on kind of funky page numbering, but it's Bates 87627.
627, yeah, got it. Okay.
There's a reference to the compliance with the written agreement. There's a reference to the compliance with the C&D.
Yep.
Up above, there's a reference to the internal controls.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into sort of the CAMEL section, except it's not. Cameo. And then you get into the scope of reviews,
yep.
and on the last page, 87637,
mm-hmm.
there's a heading at the top that says the exam focused on the key infrastructure limitations that have been identified by management with respect to the firm's correlation mm-hmm. trading activities. So it doesn't, I mean, it notes that this was done, but it doesn't sort of, in this document, the one that goes to the board, it doesn't really note the concerns, or did I?
Oh, I think it's on, it is odd pagination 1-2 or...
87625?
625, yeah.
Okay.
It makes reference, I think, to, is it board and senior management? Oh, it's referenced in the second paragraph under board and senior management oversight. Credit trading activity raises questions about the process by which.
It's the second paragraph right here.
Examinations of
yeah.
okay.
And then this would have been there is a letter associated with this exam.
Right.
Yeah. Which they would have responded to, and then this would be a reference.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the letter that they responded with, it's time to mark a new exhibit.
Okay.
What number are we at? Yeah, I know you don't know.
I do. Back to my last set of notes, though.
which are getting longer and longer as the day goes on. 39, okay. We're in the 40s, I know that. Okay. No, we went past 49. I saw it. It was 42. I don't think you did any new exhibits.
There were no new exhibits in the last interview.
Right, so it's going to be the ones before that. Let's go back to that. Mirsky, you marked 41. I think that, 42 you marked also, so you're up to 43. Yeah.
Thanks. So I'm marking as F43 letter to Diane dated March 13th, 2006, beginning with Bates 901, ending with Bates 907. So why don't you just take a couple minutes to review this and refresh.
43, right?
43, yeah.
Okay, so this would have been responding to that? So before I ask any specific questions, do you recall generally what your recollection was and your reaction to this letter was when you received it from Citigroup? I don't.
Okay.
I mean, I would have read it and then we would have talked about, I don't recall receiving this directly, but we would have talked about, okay, now what do we need to do as a team? and how would we get information about what they've put in here, and have evidence of them, you know, making progress as they indicate in their letters to us. But I don't recall receiving the letter.
Okay. So let's go to page 5.
Okay.
The part in italics at the top is the quote from the Federal Reserve letter, where essentially it's paraphrasing what you said earlier about, you know, you weren't saying a hard cap, but you're saying they needed to get better. And so they respond, "We concur that risk tools available to market risk management for the correlation desk must be considered suitably robust before renewed growth is permitted." And then they go on to describe what they characterize as substantial or progress. And I guess my question was, at that time, did you feel that they had made substantial progress, or that it was sort of they were starting to do something? And what was your expectation about growth in that business? Was it something you thought that they had suspended until they were going to get back to you on something they'd fixed? Or
yeah, I can't recall the reaction at the time about whether this was consistent or not. But
right.
I do recall when we did the exam, my impression or my recollection is it was a business that they were starting. It wasn't terribly large, but because it was complex and synthetic, that gave us pause. Synthetic made us think opacity, and we're not sure of all the potential risks. And then when we that was what determined that we should look at it originally. And then when we determined that the infrastructure was not keeping pace, and it was, if you will, they were relying on an infrastructure that was not well-suited to this type of activity, that gave us pause. But I don't... So my recollection is business they wanted to grow and budding, we had concerns, as did the OCC, about the infrastructure, indicated you have to have an infrastructure that's appropriate for the business and the risk. But I don't recall whether we felt that this was representative or not at the time.
Do you recall any conversations with either Mr. Frake or Mr. Waterhouse at the OCC about these issues?
I don't recall with Ron Frake. That probably would have been with Bill Hallisey at the time.
Right.
I don't recall conversations with Scott Waterhouse, other than I suspect we would have discussed it, because as we would be customary in our annual reports, we would have sat down and not to necessarily influence the outcome for each other, but just to say, are we being consistent in our message? So, for example, if I found an error, if there was something concerning to me and they didn't think it was concerning, why?
Right.
That would be more the basis of our conversation. We usually directionally were similar. It's just the
emphasis might be a little different.
Yeah, the perspective we might take. I have this vague recollection now of, I don't know if it was, it may have been related to this business, but us wanting to do additional follow-up work. There was a conversation about, should we look deeper? Is structured credit something else that we should take a look at? And what might our next course be in terms of examination or line of inquiry with the institution? But I have to say I'm not sure exactly how it ended up, other than I know that we had wanted to do more work in this area.
Okay. So the next document is F44. And it's just one page, and it's Bates 883. So for the record, this is appears to be notes of a meeting which you attended on May 16, 2006, along with Kathy Voits and then Bob Druskin and Ed Green from Citigroup. So the first paragraph is on the CSE update. Do you recall discussing the CSE status?
I do.
Okay.
So this would have been maybe just for context.
Sure.
We would have met. So Kathy Boyce, I don't know what role she would have had at the time. She started as, I believe, as a market and liquidity risk coordinator. And then we posted for a deputy CPC, and she would have filled that role. This was part of our meeting maybe monthly or every periodically with business heads to get a better feel for what was on their minds, what issues, et cetera. The CSE status, the SEC had contacted us about work they were doing around Citigroup's broker-dealer to become a consolidated supervised entity. And that would have allowed them to use an alternative capital regime, not quite Basel II, but something that was acceptable, if my recollection is correct, to, I don't know why, but I think it had more grounding in what the European Commission was expecting of broker-dealers who had activities in their jurisdictions. And that gave some impetus to the creation of the CSE determination by the SEC.
And so did people here at the Fed have a view on the appropriateness of Citi seeking CSE status or how well the SEC was monitoring or supervising entities?
I don't know if we had a view on the appropriateness of the CSE regime, but I do know that it would have been, and I've forgotten how the divisions were labeled at the time, but the unit within the SEC that was exploring or reviewing some of Citi's practices would get in did reach out to us to say where there is overlap to work that you would normally do or meetings you would have, you're welcome to participate with us. So some of our examiners, particularly in the models and methodology unit that we have here in RISC, who are statisticians or PhD economists who look at modeling techniques, would have sat in on some of those discussions. I recall us having conversations with the SEC, because I don't recall, I thought it was a very long lead time. It was a year or so, or perhaps longer, when they were evaluating different activity of the firm, and then at some point coming to the, reaching the conclusion that they felt that the firm was eligible for CSE status, and that some of its portfolios, as a result, would get this different capital treatment.
In your subsequent dealings with the SEC, did you form a view on their capabilities compared to your own or the OCC's?
So we interacted with two different areas within the SEC, I guess perhaps three. One was what I would call more of the enforcement action area. They were the ones who were... it was more issues around investment advisory, lost laptops, things that were more operational in nature. We also talked with the New York SEC staff occasionally about what their views were on Citi, and then spoke with the unit in D.C. who headed up the CSE status, and I've forgotten the names of each of those departments. The unit that was more of an enforcement had a very specific mandate, very technical. They had questions that they were pursuing and would occasionally give us an update. It struck me that those that were working on the CSE status were taking more of a comprehensive view relative to their colleagues in the enforcement area, trying to get a better feel for the strength of risk management practices, the exposures, and trying to think through both the quality or the footprint of this firm, but then also involved in some of the conversations about the strength of the CSE program more broadly. So I did see those two distinct distinctions.
So I think it's fair to say that CSE folks were far more prudential in their thinking. I think it's the OCI, the OC folks were much more compliance. Might gather from office compliance and inspections.
Yeah, I forget what the operative was.
Compliance with rule X, Y, yeah. or Z.
Right.
Yeah. It's just a very different focus in those two yeah. groups of people.
And it also struck me that they did not speak often to each other, those two areas. So I sometimes had meetings, and this was part of a general outreach we were having. Obviously, we wanted to strengthen our discussion with the OCC. With the SEC, it could be the case that I might have a meeting with, or we, not me just personally, but we might have a meeting with the two different areas, and they will not have talked to each other prior.
I'm just smiling because I used to work in a big law firm, and there were definitely arms of our organization that didn't talk to each other. Lawyers can be like that.
Okay.
So I'd like to draw your attention next to F34, which is Bates 884 to 886.
That's F. What did you say?
No, this is F34. This
right,
is
right, and I'm just writing it on.
Okay.
This one
didn't
have it written.
So it's it's like 2.5 pages.
Okay.
It appears to again be meeting minutes. So why don't you just skim those for a second? So, Steve, I'm going to ask some questions of you now. So you'll be able to.
Your turn. Yeah.
You'll be able to jump in on this. So, in this, on page two, it goes into sort of the hedge fund relationship that Citi had, and as I understand it, the Bear Stearns Asset Management had sponsored several hedge funds. And that there were several relationships between Citigroup and these Bear Stearns-sponsored hedge funds. The hedge funds purchased some of the equity pieces of the CDO tranches, the ones being the riskiest chunk. And it's also my understanding that there were several hundred million dollars in credit from a Citigroup entity extended to the Bear Stearns hedge funds as well. And in looking at page two, the last bullet point, it says a liquidity crisis will cause significant repricing pressure, especially with traditional / bridge lending and CDO products. So I guess my first question is, do you have a recollection about what that bullet point was referring to?
I have a recollection of this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We were having sort of general credit risk discussions, I think not just with Citi, but with other institutions. And so this would have been, Fred Harriman at the time was the head of the credit risk area here at the New York Fed within bank supervision. I don't recall this bullet. I recall we had had a lot of focus on counterparty credit risk related to hedge funds, not just at Citi but at other places. We were also doing work as a result of what was arising through prime brokerage, and also concerned about what we were seeing in other exposures that I think some of the lockups and things were talking about how quickly they could, how was it that the firms were protecting themselves in Citi in particular if there was a hedge fund counterparty who was in bad condition. I don't recall. I can deduce, but I don't recall the substance of that particular bullet.
That has to do with the. That has to do. It seems to me from reading that that has to do with the for sale. No, for sale out of a hedge fund who's invested in something because their investors want to redeem out of that hedge fund. I mean, they're talking about like 1 month.
So a liquidity crisis at the hedge fund causing the hedge fund then had to.
My recollection at this point in time, people had talked a lot about redemption gates. This was a feature that many hedge funds were starting to build in because they had pricing power to do that. In general, my understanding is that sort of, as a formal contractual feature for a hedge fund, a formal gate, which would be something like, if more than 25% of your investors seek redemption, let's say you have quarterly redemptions, in a quarter, you can freeze redemptions for the entire fund, and then let people out, sort of at some portion of time. And that's to just prevent the liquidity problem that funds found themselves in. So they talk here about fund to funds. Sometimes as an intermediary, fund to fund will have its own liquidity resources, so they can intermediate between investors there and then the ultimate manager that they're putting the funds into. I'm pretty certain that that's what that means.
Okay. So did in your work at Bear Stearns, where you probably got there too late to sort of look at the collapse of the
CDO. BSAM had already occurred.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're talking about the Enhanced Leverage Fund and the I forget their names.
Right.
It's been a while, actually. That happened in, I guess it was 07. That had already occurred. Bear was, and that was actually fairly, so that had already occurred.
Okay. So the next document is F-18, which is Bates 700 to 702.
it might be worth... No, we'll keep going.
No, go ahead.
No, it's all right. I might delay you. So.
It's Monday. It's not Friday.
I don't think I have that one for some reason.
Really?
F-18? Yeah, it might have ended up downstairs. So
oh. Okay.
Okay. I'm sure I had it on Friday, but
all right.
I don't have it today. Mm-hmm.
Just take a minute.
Sure.
So, in looking at the very broad arc of Citigroup, again, at a very superficial level, what I see is a whole bunch of really not connected problems, but high-profile issues sort of in the 2000 to 2005 time period. You know, the Dr. Evil bond trading.
MTS. Yeah. Okay.
The Japan, mm-hmm. Enron, WorldCom, Parmalat. I mean, you know, no common thread, just a whole lot of stuff. Some of it costly, all of it fairly embarrassing for the organization. And then, you know, you see the supervisors, the Fed as well as the OCC, respond with a variety of actions from 03, 04, 05. And then in 06, basically all the restrictions start coming off, including the restriction on significant acquisitions that was put on as part of the First American mm-hmm. bank shares, whatever the Texas bank was called. And that in sort of hindsight, it appears that there had been a lot of pent-up demand at Citi to increase its risk exposure that had been sort of kept in place by the supervisors. And once these various restrictions were taken off, it was sort of viewed as a green light by Citi, notwithstanding the sort of statements they made in their March letter to you or in a similar March letter to the OCC about how, you know, oh, our risk controls are going to be in place before we grow our businesses. We understand this. So you see from 06 to 07 that the leveraged loan pipeline, where the risk management approves an increase from $35 million to $50 billion, from $50 billion to $100 billion. You see the CDO exposures, they're constantly hitting the limit at $30 billion and having a temporary increase, and then they finally give another temporary increase to $36 billion. And it's, you know, it's all Bushnell approving this stuff, so it's not sort of, you know, it's not an operational risk red flag, you know, the business units have gone around it. But basically, it looks like in that 06 to 07 period, risk management didn't really do what they said they would do back in March of 06 when they communicated both to you as well as to the OCC about, you know, making sure that there would be significant controls in place before they expanded their businesses.
And I would say, so maybe I'll... I would say, so I can't speak for how the firm would have viewed the lifting of the agreements and the CNDs. I see those as slightly different, that Citi Financial, you know, treating customers poorly and having to pay a penalty for it in their consumer finance operation, and then Enron related to tax accounting, legal and reputational. And then there were all those other things that you described. My impression is that at the same time, the firm was having, I think it's referenced in there, kind of jogged my memory, operating leverage was something that they were concerned about. Some, you know, that earning, while revenue was up, expenses were also up. So net income, while still outperforming, or, you know, still, you know, earning lots of net income, not as much as they would have expected. My impression is also that the organic growth is some of what you mentioned in the structured area, but is also taking place in mortgages, corporate lending, non-leveraged lending. I think there was a general, in hindsight, you know, a general objective to try to grow, to recoup what they, or try to correct for this thing that they're not able to solve on the operating leverage. The structured finance would have been part of it. So I don't, I mean, I don't quite see them as tied. I think there might have been several motivations, but I could see if you're not, you don't understand the distinctions between what all those different events were, I don't see them as quite as tied, except with the exception of the lift on the mergers and acquisitions. That then translated into, I thought it was about a half dozen or up to a dozen small consumer finance acquisitions, which at the time, I don't think accounted for perhaps a third of the balance sheet growth, or it wasn't the bulk of the balance sheet growth, but so they were growing their businesses organically.
Right.
I remember there was lots of emphasis on the consumer side, more so even than the structured credit, if my recollection is right. And then in addition, there were acquisitions in Consumer Finance International.
Okay. So then the next document I have is SF15, the roll-up presentation for 2006.
That's number
378 to 433. So first of all, why don't you just sort of generically describe to me what a roll-up presentation is?
So we have a process here for vetting process. We would LFIT was the system-wide, or is still, I guess, in place, supervisors. So when we first started, you asked who the senior relationship managers would have reported to. That's the head of relationship here at this Reserve Bank. And where there were other large institutions, this committee was formed of that individual and their peers at different Reserve Banks. And these large institutions would have included Citigroup and maybe a couple dozen other institutions. That group would meet periodically to vet various issues, including the strength of the risk management and risks associated with an institution. And in fact, I think that document, the Citigroup year in review, was part of the communication we would have had with this body. So what happens is locally, a Reserve Bank would confer everybody in bank supervision who had worked on something related to the institution to outline our thoughts on how we would rate the institution, which is done at least annually and is communicated in the annual inspection report. As part of that process, we would have formally vetted our findings with this organization, the LFIT. We would then consider any feedback they would have given to see if we should change or reconsider, because they would have had insights from other institutions who would have had a similar footprint or perhaps a similar issue. We would factor that into our internal vettings, which next would be the head of supervision here and also with board staff head of supervision before this was captured in a report to the firm. And the report to the firm would have gone through a similar vetting process. The report to the firm would not have gone to the LFIT, but would have gone through a vetting here of this senior management and then confirmed with the head of supervision and his or her designees at the time to make sure we're all consistent or comfortable with the message. So this is, I'm imagining from the title, this would be a type of presentation we would have given in advance of the discussion and then had a discussion with them in person.
So flipping to page 12, asset quality.
Mm-hmm.
The third bullet point, or the second indented mm-hmm. bullet point, city's subprime mortgage portfolio representing 24% of city's overall mortgage portfolio and 6.5% of total consumer exposure is performing better than peer.
Mm-hmm.
I take it that's a measure of just pure mortgage loans and not
mm-hmm.
sort of any aggregation of other exposures to subprime?
So this would have been predominantly in, I think it was the bank, OTS, and other non-bank lending, the on-balance sheet, what they would have originated, not what they would have had exposure to through the packaging.
Right.
Or the bundling that we talked about through structured credit.
So one of the things that we've learned in talking to the folks directly at Citi was that by this time the MBS desk mm-hmm. had started to slow down because they were seeing a big uptick in early defaults on the hybrid ARMs that they were purchasing.
So for packaging?
For packaging.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that at this point in time, you've got the MBS desk sort of stepping on the brakes,
mm-hmm.
but the CDO desk still in early 07 has the gas pedal to the floor, trying to do as many synthetic CDOs as they can. Were you ever aware of sort of either the communication or lack of communication between the MBS desk and the CDO desk? Was that something that...
I'm not aware of what type of communication that they would have had. I do recall we would have monitored the CDO activity through our market risk monitoring. This would have been thinking about what I would call the on the portfolio that they held.
Right.
I'm not aware of... I don't recall recollections of us discussing communication between cities' two different areas. Other than, I do recall us having conversations and asking, around this time, there was more of a... I'm probably getting... lots of discussion both here and trying to understand city's exposure. This is what allows for the comparison. How is it performing? Is this all of the exposure that the firm had? And I seem to recall we had conversations with city senior management, them too confirming that their exposure of subprime is contained. That said, on reflection, that was about the mortgages that they were originating and managing, not what they had through their structure, the potential exposure they had through their structured activity.
Right. So what was, if you recall, what was your overall assessment of Citigroup's financial strength and condition at this period?
If I recall, they were, and let me just look through to make sure I'm speaking here. So we were evaluating, when we looked at capital and liquidity and earnings. So earnings were strong. I think they were strongest the past couple of years than they had been in net income, even adjusting for sort of exceptional items that were not recurring. So if I recall correctly, they had a lot of sales of things and purchases of things, so we would tend to strip those out to think about the earnings stream. We looked at capital composition. We were very concerned about hybrid securities and how much reliance they had on that in their common equity block. And if I recall correctly, let me just look through. Much of their common equity base was they accreted through retained earnings and did not have a large reliance on hybrid or preferred securities, which we tend to think is second order for loss absorption. Liquidity risk management, I also think we had a couple of reviews and had a lot of continuous monitoring around liquidity and found at the time, we thought it to be a very strong position. In hindsight, I'm not sure that they prepared as well. They were as prepared and obviously weren't for all the contingent claims and the other use of liquidity at the time. And asset quality, again, as I mentioned, we were focused on the portfolios that they originated and managed. Less on, I would say, the warehouse or things, and even leverage lending pipeline that should the markets seize up, what would they have an exposure to? I think that's all the components.
So flipping back to page 41, the second main bullet point, sound underwriting contributed to limited subprime deterioration.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that refers to the on-balance sheet mortgage loans.
We were focused like a laser on that, yeah.
So then moving on to the section on market risk, because that's where the CDO stuff would pop up.
Mm-hmm.
On page 44, it says market risk is moderate and MRM, market risk management, remains satisfactory in managing and monitoring exposure. So, in hindsight, would you say that the market risk was actually probably higher than moderate?
Well, I don't know if it would be market risk or... So I tend to think about, I think we talked about this a bit, is the liquidity puts at a credit component to it. It's sort of a contingent claim that perhaps you think about it. I'm not sure if market risk is the right area or credit risk or this contingent element and how you would evaluate the exposure in an adverse environment. I'm not sure if it would be tagged to market risk, but would be about risk management more broadly.
Is that sort of part of the problem with this particular product's probably too narrow a word, because it's not only the product, but it's the structure as well, is that it presented risks which didn't sort of neatly fit into one particular risk bucket? That it's not, you know...
I would say this is how we, if I may, I mean,
sure.
We would artificially divide up the world into credit market, more for responsibility purposes, but
right.
not, but try to talk about the issues. This doesn't give justice to the way in which the topics would be discussed. So I think you would find the CDO monitoring through Bill Hallisey, who had market risk, but market risk was a synonym for us for investment bank. So I think my impression or recollection is that all facets of exposure to the CDO business were distilled in MIS. I think it's more getting at this point of the exposure that became really problematic. All market indicators, and including some of our perspective, would have pointed to there being less risk than there was.
Can I just drive my view on this?
Sure.
I don't think this is the institution's view. So, you know, people talk about counterparty credit risk, market risk, traditional credit risk. The issues within these CDOs that you're talking about are simply structuring risks. Counterparty credit risk related to hedge funds has a lot more to do with market risk because, you know, the credit exposure a firm has is just driven simply as a function of, X, Y, or Z market variable. There is no fundamental credit analysis that you do with, in my view, a hedge fund. You don't put a lot of reliance on their capital base. It'll evaporate overnight.
Right.
And so, you know, what you want to do is measure your exposure over some horizon, measure your ability to exit those positions if you need to, and how much collateral you have. So the vectors that drive that risk are market risk vectors, just the way a firm who's exposed to some residual risk in its equity portfolio or its bond portfolio have market risk. The issue with the CDOs is one of fundamental credit risk. How do you want to evaluate the credit risk inherent in a portfolio of loans, the diversification you get, you know, when you repackage them, and, you know, how you structure it? So, my view is that there are fundamental credit risk questions that you know, should be asked, and fundamental sort of market risk, and who the counterparties are, and sort of, you know, how you want to break it up is really not that important.
Right.
It's how the risk to the firm, you know, gets conveyed that's important.
And one of the, and
so to answer, let me just say this, to answer your question, every issue I think you've raised today is a simple one, which is how much risk were there in super senior CDOs, and, you know, that was a question whose answer was, you know, not accurate.
And I guess the other question is sort of who is looking at what, right? Because, you know, coming in and being sort of the outside eyes looking at this stuff fresh for the first time, you know, we talked to Bill Hallisey on
Friday,
and we asked him about the liquidity puts. And he said, well, you know, from my perspective, I wasn't that concerned about the liquidity puts because I'm looking at the thing as a whole, and I view them as sort of the, you know, economic functional of the underlying assets. So I'm not that concerned about the liquidity put nature. When we talk with the folks from the OCC, they'll say, well, yeah, we knew about the liquidity puts. We knew they were there. And they did the same sort of review that you guys had done with the Enron-style agreement. So they'd seen the liquidity puts, but then they saw that, you know, these things were backed by super senior AAA CDOs, but they didn't know sort of what was underneath that. They didn't understand that these were subprime CDOs as opposed to the other sort of instruments that had predominated earlier in the Citibank years. And, you know, they complained about the Graham-Leach-Bliley limitations on their ability to look outside the bank over to the broker-dealer, saying, look, they fundamentally changed the business on us in London, and we didn't understand that. They changed what they were doing, and we had no way of knowing that because it's out of our ability to question.
How does the Graham-Leach-Bliley limitation apply to a exposure in the bank?
Well, it doesn't apply to the exposure in the bank, but it applies to the CDO creation process. So they're saying we can't look at the broker dealer and what they're putting into these pots.
So
what they're saying.
So my recollection is that the OCC explored the business line of investment banking rigorously and would often comment on, so I can't put myself in their shoes, but I do know on occasion they would say things about the strength of the Citigroup controls. So that leads me to believe that they had, you know, but I don't know what they were constrained by, but at times they were, because of the business line functioned and the way they operated, they had to think beyond just what was present or booked into the legal vehicle, but more what's the process around which that leads to an exposure being booked in the bank. That said, I can't speak directly to their perspective in this particular area, but I do know that it is, for example, we present our findings to both to the board of the group.
Right.
We have meetings with lots of individuals around Citigroup, not just Citibank, to try to get perspective and context.
If.
I don't know if you... I'm probably being restrained.
I'm just telling you what they tell me. Like, that's the benefit of you guys going second.
Yeah.
All right. The next document. Where are we in the...
Around 45, 46. Let's see.
Pick one.
45. I like that one better.
There's something you wanted to say.
No, I mean, sure. I mean, I think the... I'm not aware if we had a concern with a credit in an institution that we would accept as a viable answer from an organization that we don't know what's in firm X. We don't know what their business is. We don't know what their balance sheet is composed of. We don't understand how that... I'm just talking about plain corporate exposure.
Right.
That we have, you know, written a backup revolver to for their CP program. I'm not really clear that that would be an acceptable answer to us, certainly, in terms of as a basic matter of, you know, sound underwriting.
But if I can just...
You don't have to extend credit. It's that simple.
But, I mean, I guess the question that might be lurking here is, okay, why didn't we see this risk?
In terms of, right, you know, contingent liquidity,
right, exactly,
claims,
right,
inside a bank?
Uh-huh.
So I'm not clear why we would... why. So if you assume that the structuring of the transaction is accurate, mm-hmm, and you know, and I would rely on the people inside the bank itself, mm-hmm, you know, who supervise that as well as that organization itself to do the proper, mm-hmm, you know, supervision or risk management, you know, along those, you know, for those exposures, there's nothing that sort of strikes me on its face that would make me question either of those things.
Another factor to my mind is also sort of market acceptance, and there were other, it wasn't just relying on management's own view, but rather management, in hindsight, likely flawed assessment on market and different market participants attesting to what they thought the strength given subordination, the structure. I mean, many market indicators suggesting that this is not necessarily so risky as it ended up being, I'd say.
True. Yeah. No, the I think it's safe to say that Citi was not the only one in this pond, but they were probably the biggest player in the pond.
My impression is that they were, well, do you mean in terms of liquidity puts for EB? Yeah.
Well, both for CDOs backed by subprime mortgages, the origination and structuring of those CDOs, and for liquidity puts for asset-backed commercial paper backed by those same CDOs.
My impression, and I can't speak to the CDO of subprime, but CDO business more broadly, they were one of the largest arrangers and notionals, I would say, in league tables, was my impression. In terms of liquidity facility providers, I think they also were more ABCP of a plain vanilla form, not the super senior. So in total, I would say, yes, it's likely they did have a huge, very large market share in this type of liquidity facility put provision.
So F46 is a document produced by Citi, obtained through your records. Bates number?
We're on 45.
We're on 45.
Yep.
Oh, you marked that one. Then.
Never mind. 45 it is. I'm just jumping around.
It's uncomfortable.
That's Bates 950 to 960. Here you can start to flip through it while she's looking to see.
I'm just hunting mine down. Yeah, there we go.
So the first couple of pages are just sort of structural depictions of how various CDOs are created. Then you get into sort of the global CDO market showing growth through 2005. And then sort of the lead table standing showing Citigroup first in notional total CDO, first in notional ABS CDO, and first in notional and CLOs for 2005. 2006, Merrill was first and Citi was second. Then it's sort of the last page that I'm actually most interested in. There's a little box on the last page where it shows
P&L? Is the P&L box? Yeah.
Okay. And I'm actually talking about the box on the right.
Okay.
It makes three statements. CEO business has been growing at a fast pace. Secondary trading is growing. And then the business is not only profitable, but also a source of cross-sell across Citigroup, REITs, IPOs, or asset purchases from other fixed income desks. And sort of the picture that I have of the universal bank model, if that's what this can be called, the combination of investment banks and depositories, is that the ability to access liquidity puts, the ability to access credit default swaps, which counterparties wanted to do with Citibank NA because of its preferred status, is that it gave the investment bankers a chance to grow faster and do more deals than they would have otherwise been able to do on a standalone basis. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Look at Wachovia. They did $19.2 billion in 2005. Do you have Wachovia was not a giant organization by any means.
Yeah.
So, to your point.
Yeah. Right. So what's your view on sort of how to contain the animal spirits of the investment bankers when times are good? Because you know they're going to want to, as this shows, it's a very profitable business. They're going to want to push it as far as they can. Whereas sort of the traditional depository institution culture is like, you know, we know what happens when loans go bad. What's your idea on how the model works to make sure these things don't happen in the future? And you can each take a shot.
No, I'll let you go first.
I'll let you go first. May I just take a break?
Oh, sure.
Back, yeah. Yeah, okay.
So I'm going to take a break, too.
Sorry.
So we can all think about that.
Okay.